the 40 days of the soul begin on the morning after death. That first night, before its 40 days begin, the soul lies still against sweated-on pillows and watches the living fold the hands and close the eyes, choke the room with smoke and silence to keep the new soul from the doors and the windows and the cracks in the floor so that it does not run out of the house like a river.
This is Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB, and I am your host, Gil Manser. Tonight's intriguing and fast-paced conversation is with Taya Obret, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tiger's Wife. Born in Belgrade and honoring her grandfather's dying wish that she write using his last name, Taya Obret's debut novel, The Tiger's Wife, won Britain's Orange Broadband Prize for 2011. Set in a fictional country, Taya describes her book as a family saga featuring a female narrator and the relationship with her physician grandfather and death after all those wars in the Balkans. Originally excerpted in The New Yorker, The Tiger's Wife quickly topped the bestseller lists. So, Taya, you emigrated to the United States when you were 12, but lived in Cyprus and Egypt after your family moved from Yugoslavia when the war started. Perhaps you could share with our readers the historic upheaval as the Yugoslav Federation disintegrated.
Certainly, I can give a brief summary of it.
Well, I think it's helpful because a lot of our listeners vaguely remember it, but they weren't living it like you were.
That's right, and I know that it was a complicated conflict, made further complicated by an array of difficult to remember names and place names and very Slavic language based, all of it. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yes.
The former Yugoslavia was a place inhabited by several Balkan states.
Can I read them?
Yes.
Croatia,
please.
Montenegro, Serbia, Slovenia, Bosnia Herzegovina, and Macedonia, with the two provinces of Kosovo and Vojvodina.
Vojvodina.
Say that again.
Vojvodina.
Given us autonomous status,
it was the states were joined together. Even though previously, in their previous incarnations, they had all been annexes of different empires,
right,
that had been at
Turks
war with each other.
And,
exactly,
right.
Ottoman Turks, and then the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Right.
Some of the grudges that broke Yugoslavia up following the death of Tito seemed to rest on things that happened, religions that were subscribed to under different imperial rule, the grudges that the states under the yoke of different empires bore against each other. For
some hundreds or thousands of years old.
Exactly. Hundreds.
Thousands.
You're right. And when Tito died.
He had kind of held the thing together under a communist dictatorship with a really hard line, "You will all agree."
He had held it under a communist dictatorship and, contrary to contrary to the way he's sometimes perceived in the West, and when asked about Tito, people who grew up in Tito's time seem to have generally, there's like a 80-20 ratio of people who think of it as a very positive time.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it was peaceful.
Right. It was peaceful.
Right.
It was functional. There was a sense of equality and, being able to rise. I mean, of course, it was like any other system. It was extremely corrupt and not everybody was dealt a fair hand. But a lot of people remember it quite fondly and are very vocal about that. Following his death, political aspirants, is that a
sure? Jostled for power.
Jostled for power and seemed to take a very nationalistic track in their approach to running things from then
us
on.
Us versus them.
And in a situation where certain families had been brought up to believe that there was no other, it was all just us,
right.
It became very difficult because it was certainly not the belief of everybody. And in a lot of cases, was the glib political spin under which these ideas were seeded to the public, these nationalistic ideas. And, you know, it led to war that was ethnically and religiously based.
Right.
But following the dissolution of following the death of Tito, the dissolution was premised on these different religions being very relevant to one's sense of ethnicity, which was problematic for families like mine that were made up of all the ethnicities. I'm a Slovene Roman Catholic and Bosnian Muslim who was born in Serbia.
Right.
And my stepdad is a practicing Orthodox Serb.
Okay.
So we celebrate Christmas twice.
Well, yeah, on the 6th, is it? The
7th? On the 7th. And we, you know, we have the unleavened cake and the coin inside. Yeah.
So tell us about your grandfather. Now, he was a real person, and you write about a grandfather in your book who I understand the man in the book is a physician.
He is.
And your grandfather was some kind of engineer, am I remembering?
Yes, he was an aeronautical engineer. Yeah, he made airplanes. Ironically, following, you know, 20-odd years of knowing him, I'm still afraid to fly. Yeah.
So we know a little bit about the background. We know the setting. Your novel is told in the present and the past.
Yes.
We go back to World War II.
We do.
We go back to 1992 era. We go back to when the protagonist is 4. Is that the first time we see
That's
her
right.
at the zoo?
Yeah.
And she is a young doctor in a fictional Balkan nation, which I think was very wise of you to do.
Well, thank you.
Because you're crossing borders frequently, and I was trying to figure out which one it was. Although I think Belgrade is pretty obvious.
Belgrade is fairly obvious.
Especially with the bombs coming down when the tigers –
Yeah.
First we meet
yeah.
the tiger.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a – you know, when you search the date, 1941, bombing
right.
Balkans,
right.
you'll find
– There's newsreels of that even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Natalia recalls the childhood visits with her grandfather in flashbacks, especially those instances revolving around two magical stories, The Deathless Man and The Tiger's Wife, which is, of course, the name of your novel.
That's right.
Tell us a little about The Deathless Man, because we're going to talk more and get some excerpts from the tiger.
The Deathless Man is a figure who appears in the grandfather's life when the grandfather is himself just coming to to medicine, to medical practice. The Deathless Man is this figure whom he meets sort of under mysterious circumstances following an outbreak of disease in the village that he arrives to treat and realizes that the outbreak is minute in comparison to the problem the village is having with this figure who seems to have appeared and risen out of his coffin during his own funeral. So he develops a relationship with this man who seems to appear who claims to be immortal, and who seems to appear wherever people are dying in large numbers in an effort to redeem himself and bring the notion of a peaceful death to the dying. Which is something that the dying.
And the redemption comes from something this man has done, shall we call it, deal with the devil.
That's right. That's right.
That's a very famous story. It's in Freudian, you know, literature and archetypes and such with Jung.
It's taken from an archetypal story, and it's usually this very unlike most Balkan and Germanic folktales as well. It's not, you know, that long rambling one that you know starts in one place and ends in with a completely different character and an entirely different mission. It's sort of very to the point and moralistic. You will accept your mortality. It's going to happen, and here's why. usually it involves a man who's sort of a village idiot and tricks or traps death in some way,
right.
and is then punished either with immortality or immediate death.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what I was going through with the death of my grandfather, I was very interested in this idea of.
Now this happened at the same time you were writing.
This happened several months before I started.
Before you started the novel,
that's right.
Had you written parts of it as short stories before?
I had written a short story based in the Balkans before that had a figure very similar to the Deathless Man, only much more sinister.
Mm-hmm.
And that figure sort of carried over the idea of that figure. I had questions about his continuing story, even though in that particular short story, he was really more like death than the Deathless Man. And you know, he had like an axe and a bag over his shoulder and like a machete hidden in his pants. You
that's
know,
the Germanic version.
That's right.
No, I think there's a reason for that. I think in the German version, the Grimm's fairy tale kind of story, they had their existence was much less fraught with horror than the people in the Balkans who were constantly being invaded.
And, that's right. You know, so as he developed, and I was, you know, trying to figure out this question of immortality as punishment, he became a more and more sympathetic character because he was supposed to, the deathless man was supposed to be entirely sinister, and then he sort of became this funny, lost kind of figure who you know, is very frustrated by the fact that his efforts to bring peace to others are met with, you know, violence and derision.
What this book allows you to do, and you combine folktales and stories told by the grandfather mm-hmm. to his granddaughter and things that may or may not have happened involving animals, which is fascinating. I mean, I'm talking wild animals you would not usually see in Yugoslavia.
Yes.
Not just bears and deer, but tigers and elephants and you know, ferocious beasts. So I think it would be interesting to hear our listeners, have our listeners hear how you write and also to hear the background of the people and the thought processes that they are going through.
The 40 days of the soul begin on the morning after death. That first night, before its 40 days begin, the soul lies still against sweated-on pillows and watches the living fold the hands and close the eyes, choke the room with smoke and silence to keep the new soul from the doors and the windows and the cracks in the floor so that it does not run out of the house like a river. The living know that at daybreak, the soul will leave them and make its way to the places of its past, the schools and dormitories of its youth, army barracks and tenements, houses razed to the ground and rebuilt, places that recall love and guilt, difficulties and unbridled happiness, optimism and ecstasy, memories of grace meaningless to anyone else. And sometimes this journey will carry it so far for so long that it will forget to come back. For this reason, the living bring their own rituals to a standstill. To welcome the newly loosed spirit, the living will not clean, will not wash or tidy, will not remove the soul's belongings for 40 days, hoping that sentiment and longing will bring it home again, encourage it to return with a message, with a sign, or with forgiveness. If it is properly enticed, the soul will return as the days go by to rummage through drawers, peer inside cupboards, seek the tactile comfort of its living identity by reassessing the dish rack and the doorbell and the telephone, reminding itself of functionality, all the time touching things that produce sound and make its presence known to the inhabitants of the house.
You go on because something's happened here that brings up why you need to discuss that. Because Natalie has received a phone call from her grandmother saying that her grandfather has died.
That's right.
And he's in some little village somewhere and they're going to ship the body to him. So at least 3 or 4 days have passed.
That's right.
And the soul has not been at peace during that time.
Exactly. And they've been continuing on with their normal living rituals without any
– just through ignorance.
Right.
Of the event.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. So Natalia is asked to – you know, asked about her own knowledge of his death and whether or not she knew that this was forthcoming. She lies and says no.
Because she did know something.
Because she did know. She was the only one in the family who knew that that he was dying. That
Stage 4 cancer.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things people have commented, because this is a first novel and because you've become so widespread with your awards and, you know, shall we say, in the center of the spotlight, you've had your share of critics. And one of the things they talk about is you write with a literary style, too much of a literary style, whatever that means.
I'm not sure what that means, but I do have a problem with sentences that don't flow well, I can spend, you know, days on a particular sentence. If a sentence that's, you know, first in the book, first in the chapter, first of the paragraph, first of the day is not going well.
Doesn't sound right to your ear?
It doesn't sound right to me. It isn't saying what I needed to say. It's just not setting anything up. I can't move beyond it. And this can this can last for weeks, frustration with that paragraph. And, you know, I'll just move on and write something else. Mm-hmm. Because if it doesn't sound right, I can't go on.
It's your self-editor.
Yeah, right. I am. And, I mean, I don't know if that has something to do with – I have the same – it's like a physical reaction. And I have the same frustrating reaction to words that are misspelled. But this might have something to do with – I see words phonetically, and it might have something to do with the fact that my first language was Serbo-Croatian.
Well, how many languages do you speak or read?
Just – well, I speak Serbo-Croatian and English, you know, fluently. I have a moderately good grasp of French.
Huh.
Also, you know, to read as well. But so when I see a word I don't see conscience. I see conscience.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you do select your words very carefully.
Thank you.
Because let me ask you about a specific word. Okay, this is quite early in the book. It's when you're going to the zoo, and you're the I'm sorry, not you. The 4-year-old
That's okay.
is going to the zoo.
It happens all the time.
And it has this line. They're basically standing outside of the tiger cage, and it starts, "I remember this too." An altercation. Did you pick that word intentionally? Did you think about that? Altercation. For what you describe is, to my mind, much more than that.
I did pick that word, yeah. It's
We're going to have you read what happens and
sure.
see what our listeners think.
It's that prologue is one of the oldest things in the book.
Hmm.
That prologue was there when the book was a thesis.
That prologue
came out of nowhere following the writing of a particularly bad short story called The Tiger's Wife that sounded more like an outline and sort of was about the Balkans and this little boy who witnesses an interaction between a circus performer and her escaped tiger who's terrorizing the little boy's village. It was a terrible short story. But no, I showed it to my editor years later when the book was already published, and sort of there was silence on his side for a long time. Mm. And then he said, "I see where a lot of this comes from. That's nice."
The title, in other words,
yeah, the
yes,
title.
Right.
So
we're back to this altercation. Why don't we have you read where it says start?
Mm-hmm.
It's a couple pages and goes to stop. Okay,
sure. Absolutely.
This one I've marked for you, so
oh,
it's
lovely.
Much
Thank
easier.
You. I remember this, too, an altercation. A small group of people stand clustered around the tiger's cage. Among them, a boy with a parrot-shaped balloon, a woman in a purple coat, and a bearded man who is wearing the brown uniform of a zookeeper. The man has a broom and a dustpan on a long handle, and he is sweeping the area between the cage and the outer railing. He walks up and down, sweeping up juice boxes and candy wrappers, bits of popcorn people have tried to throw at the tigers. The tigers walk up and down with him. The woman in purple is saying something and smiling, and he smiles back at her. She has brown hair. The dustpan keeper stops and leans against the handle of his broom, and as he does so, the bigger of the two tigers sweeps by, rubbing against the bars of the cage, rumbling, and the keeper puts a hand through the bars and touches its flank. For a moment, nothing, and then pandemonium. The tiger rounds on him, and the woman shrieks, and suddenly the dustpan keeper's shoulder is between the bars, and he is twisting his head away and trying to reach for the outer railing so that he has something to hold on to. The tiger has the dustpan keeper's arm the way a dog holds a large bone, upright between its paws, gnawing on the top. Two men who have been standing by with children jump over the railing and grab the dustpan keeper's waist and flailing arm and try to pull him away. A third man jams his umbrella through the bars and pushes it over and over again into the tiger's ribs. An outraged scream from the tiger, and then it stands up on its hind legs and hugs the dustpan keeper's arm and shakes its head from side to side like it's pulling on rope. Its ears are flattened, and it is making a noise like a locomotive. The dustpan keeper's face is white, and this entire time he hasn't made a sound. Then suddenly it's no longer worth it, and the tiger lets go. The three men fall away, and there is a splatter of blood. The tiger is lashing its tail, and the dustpan keeper is crawling under the outer railing and standing up. The woman in purple has vanished. My grandfather has not turned away. I am 4 years old, but he has not turned me away, either. I see it all, and later, There is the fact that he wants me to have seen. Then the dustpan keeper is hurrying our way, winding a piece of torn shirt across his arm. He is red-faced and angry, on his way to the infirmary. At the time, I believe this is fear, but later I will know it as shame. The tigers, agitated, are lunging back and forth across the grate. The keeper is leaving a dark trail in the gravel behind him. As he passes us, my grandfather says, "My God, you're a fool, aren't you?" And the man says something in reply, something I know not to repeat. Instead, shrill and self-righteous in my lacquered boots, brave because my grandfather is holding my hand, I say, "He's a fool, isn't he, Grandpa?" But my grandfather is already walking after the dustpan keeper, pulling me along, calling for the man to stop so he can help him.
That's a wonderful start.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I know it came out of supposedly nowhere, but I think there's a lot of experience on those pages.
It's experience in what sense?
Experience in one who sees things and remembers them.
Well, thank you. I that scene is something that in reality did happen. Was actually, you know, that's I think this might be the first time that I'm saying this. When I was quite little, I was actually at the zoo the one and only time my grandmother took me.
Mm.
And something very similar happened.
Interesting.
And that scene, the presence of that scene and the moment of the tiger attack presented itself before the main characters were doctors, before the grandfather had been introduced in any way, before the deathless man had entered the story. It was just, it was a way in, because the one thing that I knew going off of that short story that had failed into a longer piece was that the little boy from the short story had to be anchored to a narrator in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instant of, you know, in one of those lightning flashes where you don't really realize it's a lightning flash until months, years later,
right.
That scene came out. And as a moment between the grandfather and the granddaughter. Sort of the whole book took off from there. And
so the little boy became a little girl.
The little boy became, the little boy became the grandfather.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny, because when I was four, my parents and I went down to see the Clyde Beatty Circus. I think it was down in San Mateo or San Jose. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, driving a ways. And when we were there, one of the lions got out. They put a cage, a metal cage, a circular cage up in the middle of the room. And Clyde Beatty was that old school of lion tamer with the whips and the chair.
Nice.
Yeah. Used to wear, you know, pants that swirled out in high leather boots,
mm-hmm.
and a safari hat when he went in the cage.
That's awesome.
Anyway, this lion escaped. And I can remember sitting there completely still as the animal, you know, scurried around the cage and circled it several times in the – handlers were chasing after it.
Wow.
You know, finally caught it with a net that they threw over them and hauled it out the side door.
Wow.
on the ground. But I can remember that absolutely.
So
I mean, the smells. You talk about smells in the book, especially with when they meet another animal, and that's what I recall.
Yeah.
Is the odors that were in that tent.
Actually, when I was about the same age, we went to the circus, and I remember being terrified of the trapeze artists.
Mm.
Because I thought they were all going to die in front of me, and I was absolutely terrified. But I remember how that I remember how the room smelled, and like all your childhood memories are in this. I actually got peed on by a tiger at that circus.
Oh,
yeah.
Well,
it's all connected.
The, you know, the undead tiger woman, right?
That's right. My goodness, that's right. They put up that, you know, those
and it's very
those,
distinctive.
Those big, yeah,
oh, yeah.
Very, yeah, yeah. And they parked it right in front of me, and I remember my mother screaming as I was hit by this jet stream because it was a, you know, clearly unneutered male tiger, and they have a, you know, like 20-foot spray range. But yeah, I mean, I think that certain childhood memories are so vivid. They're more vivid than memories that you had of, you know, to something that happened to you 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of anchor parts of your identity to them. And I remember coming back to Belgrade in 2003 for the first time since we'd left in 92. And I could have found my way to the zoo.
Oh, yeah.
And I could have found my way to a couple of other places just by...
Well, is the zoo still there?
The zoo's still there. Oh. The zoo is still there. And, you know, the sort of big point of pride in Belgrade.
It's what we call an old-fashioned zoo, is that right?
That is one way to call it, yeah. I mean, it's quite old-fashioned, and I'm pretty sure that people in the States would be shocked.
Well, the cage you describe with the tigers is much smaller than... say something in San Diego.
Oh, much. And I mean, there's no, you know, landscaping.
Right. But, it's all just hard cement and stuff.
That's right. Yeah. But those animals are, you know, very well taken care of. And the zoo is like a city project. And they have, I mean, the mark of a good zoo is you know, its breeding program. And that zoo has tremendous breeding programs. But you know, I could have found my way back to a couple of places just by scent alone. You know, you sort of follow the smell of the fried dough on the corner, and then you go to the next place where they're roasting meat, and then before you know it, you're at the zoo.
That's right. You can just follow your nose.
That's right.
That's it.
Yeah.
You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, where tonight's guest is Taya Obrett, the award-winning author of the best-selling debut novel, The Tiger's Wife. I'm going to talk to, have you read something about an experience that happened late at night between the girl and her granddaughter. And it has odors, smells, senses in it, very, very important parts of it.
So there, so Natalia is quite a bit older here, and she's following her grandfather.
And she's somewhat distressed with him at this time.
That's right. They're going old. Yeah, they're going through a tension in their relationship, and they're sort of trying to reforge their bond, but she's agitated at what he's doing out late at night. When I finally caught up with my grandfather, I said, "Look, I don't know what we're doing, but I'd like to be in on it." Then suddenly he stopped in the darkness ahead of me, and my chin cracked his elbow. The force of the collision knocked me back, but then he reached for me and held my shoulder while I steadied myself. My grandfather stood on the curb, pointing into the distance of the empty street. "There," he said, "look." His hand was shaking with excitement. "I don't see anything," I told him. "Yes, you do," he said. "You do. Look." I peered out into the street, where the long blades of the rails lay slick and shining. There was a tree on the other curb, a lamppost with a dying bulb, an eviscerated dumpster lying on its side in the road. I was opening my mouth to say, "What?" And then I saw it. Half a block from where we were standing, an enormous shadow was moving along the street, going very slowly up the Boulevard of the Revolution. At first, I thought it was a bus, but its shape was too organic, too lumpy, and it was going far too slowly for that, making almost no noise. It was swaying, too, swaying up the street with an even momentum, a ballasted, rolling motion that was drawing it away from us like a tide, and every time it rocked forward, something about it made a soft, dragging sound on the rails. As we watched, the thing sucked in air and then let out a deep groan. "God," I said, "that's an elephant." My grandfather said nothing, but when I looked up at him, he was smiling. His glasses had fogged up during the walk, but he wasn't taking them off to wipe them. "Come on," he said, and took my hand. We moved fast along the sidewalk until we drew parallel, and then passed it, stopped 100 meters down so we could watch it coming toward us. From there, the elephant, the sound and smell of it, the ears folded back against the domed, bouldered head with big-lidded eyes, the arched roll of the spine falling away into the hips, dry folds of skin shaking around the shoulders and knees as it shifted its weight, seemed to take up the whole street. It dragged its curled trunk like a fist along the ground. Several feet in front of it, holding a bag of something that must have been enormously tempting, a short young man was walking slowly backward, drawing it forward with whispers. "I saw them up at the train station as I was coming home," my grandfather said. "He must be bringing it to the zoo." The young man had seen us, and as he inched back along the tramway, he nodded and smiled, pulled down his cap. Every so often, he would take something out of the bag and hold it out to the elephant, and the elephant would lift its trunk from the ground, grip the offering, and loll it back between the yellow sabers of its tusks. Later on, we would read about how some soldiers had found him near death at the site of an abandoned circus. About how, despite everything, despite closure and bankruptcy, the zoo director had said, bring him in, and eventually the kids will see him. For months, the newspapers would run a picture of him standing stark-ribbed in his new pen at the zoo, an advert of times to come, a pledge of the zoo's future, the undeniable end of the war. My grandfather and I stopped at the bus station, and the elephant passed, slow, graceful, enchanted by the food in the young man's hand. The moon threw a tangle of light into the long, soft hairs sticking up out of its trunk and under its chin. The mouth was open, and the tongue lay in it like a wet arm. "No one will ever believe this," I said. My grandfather said, "What?" "None of my friends will ever believe it." My grandfather looked at me like he'd never seen me before, like he couldn't believe I was his. Even in our estrangement, he had never quite looked at me that way, and afterward he never did again. "You must be joking," he said. "Look around and think for a moment. It's the middle of the night, not a soul anywhere. In this city, at this time, not a dog in the gutter, empty, except for the elephant, and you're going to tell your idiot friends about it? Why? Do you think they'll understand it? Do you think it will matter to them?" He left me behind and walked on after the elephant. I stood with my hands in my pockets. I felt my voice had fallen through and through me, and I couldn't summon it back to tell him or myself anything at all. The elephant was moving forward along the boulevard. I followed it. A block down, my grandfather had stopped beside a broken bench and was waiting for the elephant. I caught up with him first, and the two of us stood side by side in silence, my face burning, his breath barely audible. The young man did not look at us again. Eventually, my grandfather said, "You must understand, this is one of those moments." "What moments?" "One of those moments you keep to yourself."
One of those moments you keep to yourself. But you didn't keep that moment
except
to yourself.
Except when you put it in a book.
That's right. Exactly. Well, you see, what that does, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is it paints the relationship between the grandfather and the granddaughter. Now, you've described earlier in the book about how they're rebellious. They're using the war, the teenagers are using the war as an excuse to do dangerous and stupid things.
Yes. Unproductive,
and,
too.
Yeah, unproductive, too. And counterproductive. Right. And the grandfather has, you know, railed against that and talked about it many times with her and surprised that she's hanging around with, you know, people like that, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right,
because there's some boyfriends that are less than ideal.
That's right, yeah.
But this sighting in the middle of the night in the dark on the street of a completely improbable thing reunites them.
And I think that it's a very significant moment in the book that came about in a sort of strange way. And for a long time, a lot of people had said to me, you know, that was my favorite moment in the book, period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what is it about this elephant and what is it about the animals in general that seem to change people in this book and actually in my work, I guess, in general? And I didn't know the answer for a really long time, and I didn't know why that particular passage in the book held the significance that it did. And then
the significance in the book, or the significance to other people,
both, both, because its significance in the book, I think, sort of, I mean, it if a reader likes the book, that seems to be the moment that really rallies them behind Natalia and the grandfather and their relationship.
I would agree, yeah.
I realized—
Because they have a secret now.
That's right. They
a
have
bond.
A secret now.
You
have
no
it with
one
them.
Else.
That's
because
right.
She hasn't told it. It's this magic event.
That's right. That's right. And that's still perfectly possible and is going on in the real world. But it's something that is, you know, between them. And it changes the way that Natalia sees the world and certain significant – the things that are significant in her life.
And she values her grandfather much more.
That's right. But I was recently I've been sort of rabidly getting into Joseph Campbell and The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. There's a section which he's talking about Plains Indians and their relationship to the animals that they would hunt. And he says the psyche that sees an it, I-T, is completely different than the psyche that sees a thou.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what that it or thou is, whether it's an animal, whether it's an object, whether it's a particular view of the universe, and it just knocked me on my butt. Because I realized that's what it is. That's that moment in the book. And that's what those animals are actually doing there. And everybody who faces an animal in this book is on the precipice.
It's there, so it's a shamanistic animal.
Exactly. But without, you know, without that relationship between them, it's the character's relationship to the moment, to the perception of that animal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always on the precipice of – the character's on the precipice of – trying to decide how they view the world, like what are the events that are really significant.
We have talked a bit about the animals. We have talked about the relationship between the granddaughter and the grandfather. We have talked about the fact that we find out he has died in a little village somewhere else. But you, except for the character of the people that we read about a little bit in the, I'd like you to share with us something about what I call the night diggers. The setup for that is that the two that Natalie and her best friend are doctors, and they're going across a border to take medicines to an orphanage. And it's in fact at that border crossing where she learns about her grandfather's death.
That's right.
But she does not tell her friend. And the friend is looking forward to talking to this man because she needs counsel and advice. She's in the middle of an investigation of a man they called the Iron Glove, right, who is up for malpractice. And she wants to talk to someone older who's been her mentor, and that's the grandfather. So by not letting her best friend know this, Natalie has put herself in a very awkward situation.
She has.
Yeah. But when the first night they're there, they stop in a house, and they are put up for the evening, and they have dinner, and a young girl wanders in the door. And she has this horrific, rattly cough.
Yeah.
And the reaction from the two people around the table is the man just keeps on talking as though she's not there at all. And the woman starts regaling those people. So tell us a little bit about those people.
Those people are a family who has come and is staying at the house with Natalia and her friend Zora. They are sick. It's a family of people who are ill, and they're from across the border. And
this vague somewhere else.
That's right, vague somewhere else, which turns out to be the same across the border up north as Natalia and Zora. So still those people. They are digging in the vineyard behind the house.
Around the vines.
That's right. For something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we won't tell the listeners what the something is. But anyway, she decides the next morning she's going to go out and talk to these people because she's heard more and more people coughing.
That's right.
She's touched foreheads and they're, quite feverish. And she realized that there's illness running through this group of people. So start right there.
All right. So she's talking to the head man of the family,
right,
the patriarch. I asked Dure, "How old are those kids over there?" "They're my kids," he said to me, without missing a beat. "They're smoking," I said. One of the kids had a long, thick clot of green coming out of one nostril, and as he dug, he occasionally licked it away. "Are they sick, too?" I said. Dure lensed the shovel, spade down into the dirt, and straightened up to look at me. "That's not your business," he said. "This isn't an ordinary cold. It sounds serious. That little girl could have whooping cough, bronchitis. She could end up with pneumonia." "She won't." "Has she seen a doctor?" "She doesn't need one." "What about the boys? They don't need one either?" "They'll be fine," Dure said. "I've heard you've got them out here in the afternoons in the heat. Do you know what that does if someone's got a fever?" "You've heard, have you?" he said. He was shaking his head, his chuckles weighed down by the way he was leaning forward. "We do what we have to, doctor," he said. "Don't concern yourself with it." "I'm sure you need all the hands you can get for the working season," I said, trying to sound understanding. "But you must be able to spare the boys." "Work has nothing to do with it," Dure said. "Send them down to see us," I said, pressing on, ignoring him. "We're from the university. We've got medicines for the new orphanage of Sveti Pashkal. There'll be a free clinic. My children aren't orphans." "I know," I said. "That's all right. It's free medicine." "That's all right," she says. "What's the matter with you?" he said again. "You think I want my kids around orphans?" Well, you'll put them to work when they're sick, I said loudly. Someone in the vineyard let out a low whistle, and it was followed by an explosion of laughter from the men. Dure was unfazed. All that time, he hadn't stopped digging for a moment. I could see the gaunt outline of his shoulder blades rising and falling through the gray jumpsuit. By now, this same conversation with my grandfather would probably have come to blows. I'll take good care of them, I said. This is family business, Dure told me. They're being cared for.
We've learned a lot there. Because what we, well, at least I did when I read it, and I assume that the readers, who other readers did as well, is we find out about the suspicion. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always there.
It is always there. And it's there not only across, and this is something that sort of happens, I feel like, in general, not only across ethnic lines, but across, you know, class lines as well in this book, across this idea of a particular kind of education, which is synonymous with the degradation of traditional beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
My good friend in Serbia is a doctor, so I've hung around doctors, and I hear that quite often they do have to toe the line between this medical modernity and the superstition of traditional medicine, which, you know, can work within certain to a degree.
Well, they're using that with the little girl. They've,
that's right.
They've covered her with sheets and poured an alcohol.
That's right.
It's a strong drink.
Yeah.
So that it will evaporate and cool, bring down her fever.
Which is quite frankly something that they used to do to me when I was a kid. And,
they
you
still
know,
do
we
it.
Had,
they
exactly.
actually do it
yeah.
now.
Yeah. yeah. And
with
and,
rubbing
know,
alcohol.
And
not,
here I am.
Not something
alive,
to drink.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think that the problem largely arises, you know, when you get into some serious, serious diseases. But there is this suspicion of something about your beliefs or way of thinking being laughable. And, there's then immediately a tension between the person who wants to take those beliefs and those traditions away from you.
Right.
Because the supposition is that they're not really going to take them away from you. They're just going to, you know, try to show you that there's
walk
a different way of
them.
Thinking.
Yeah.
But isn't that
yeah.
really what empires do when they come?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they sublimate your beliefs and ideas. And actually doing something that when I was back in Serbia and Croatia, actually, in 2009, I went to do research for a Harper's piece for nonfiction
mm-hmm.
That was about vampirism in the Balkans.
Mm.
And the traditional Balkan vampire, and we trundled around in a small car to a lot of villages, and asked people, rural communities, to divulge their private regional myths. And some were very willing to talk about it in this very straightforward way. Of yes, you know, we believe. You know, that there was a vampire here in the late 1800s. We'll take you up to the graveyard, show his grave. There's been other sightings and other manifestations of apparitions here that are related to that vampire and others. You know, it's a hub. And then other people would say, that's nonsense. We don't believe that. And then there would be...
But we
do lock our doors at night. And in
right.
and this particular case, it was we do leave stakes in the house that it was... not like steaks, like
or
yum,
garlic,
like steaks.
Yeah, yeah right.
We do leave steaks in the house that he was said to haunt, the water mill that he was said to haunt. But I mean, like that was part of the premise for the article. That it's so strange how far we've come from that sort of walking corpse, which is still the vampire in the Balkans today.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Nosferatu type.
That's right. There was a. One of the fascinating things about going to do that research was meeting a lot of people who would say, that's all nonsense. We didn't believe in that nonsense under Tito.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know,
so that, like, what, therefore it's all compartmentalized and we don't need to think about
exactly,
it.
Exactly. And this idea of we put aside those silly pagan beliefs because now we know better. Or something like that. But the truth is that those pagan beliefs have just manifested into different aspects of the culture. They've just sort of morphed.
Right.
And there's no reason, I mean, in my mind, there's no reason to feel ashamed of them at all, because there's something that's innate to the region and something that's innate to the mindset there. And, you know, it's quite unique.
The ethnography of the place.
That's right.
Well, I asked this of writers, and since you are – this was your first – you're working on another novel.
I am, yeah.
And this was your first novel. Do you have advice for fledgling writers?
I do. You know, there's a reason why you're writing as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
It does something to you. The act of it is, you know, sacred to you in whatever way, it in whatever place it has in your life.
That's a nice word.
Oh, thank you.
See, you pick good words.
Oh, thank you.
Say that again.
Yeah. I'm glad I was able to do that live. No, the
it's not all on Post-it notes, huh? That you have to plug in here and there.
Oh my goodness! No, but it's a, you know, the act is sacred to you for whatever reason. So that must mean.
So do you
something.
Set up your little temple of writing?
I set up a little temple. I have weird rituals for my writing. It's
not on a plane, obviously.
No, dear God, no. On a plane, I just sit there with like 6 ounces of vodka in one hand and you know
a bunch
of lorazepam in
right,
the other.
Right.
No, I have my desk set up a certain way. I have a picture that hangs over my desk that I need to be there, otherwise I feel really displaced.
Mm.
It's Salvador Dali's The Ghost of Vermeer.
Oh, that's an interesting choice.
It's there's something about it. I think, and it's a very, I mean, writing is a very private thing. The act itself is very private.
So that's your piece of advice for writers. I want to, is there something you want to share that's coming up? A new work, something coming out in a magazine people should be aware of?
There is nothing at the moment.
My gosh.
I'm quite excited to sort of be heading into this. I'm doing something for the Voyages issue. For a collection,
that's not already been printed.
That's not already been printed.
Oh, good.
But apart from that, at the moment, I've
you're in collections too, though. You're in short story, American something or other.
Best American short stories.
Best American short stories.
Non-required reading.
Non-required reading.
That's right. Oh, right. And actually, the Vampire article is in this year's Best American Travel Writing. So
okay.
That's fun.
And then it's available at what was the magazine again?
Oh, Harper's.
The book is called The Tiger's Wife. This wonderful conversation has been with Taya Obrett. I thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Word by Word. Tonight's intriguing and fast-paced conversation was with Taya Obrett, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tiger's Wife. Our sound engineers for tonight's program are Robin Pressman and Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want you to be sure to join us again for Word by Word at 7 o'clock Wednesday, March 7th, when we will have a special show featuring a conversation with Ben Marcus about his best-selling novel, The Flame Alphabet, which takes place in a parallel universe where the language of children has become toxic to adults, and especially their own parents. We will also have a sneak peek at the 5th Annual Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival, slated for March 29th through April 1st. Our show will include conversations with a few of the talented filmmakers who write, shoot, and edit their amazing documentaries. So we hope you can catch that entertaining and informative evening right here on KRCB 91.1 FM. But until then, we wish you a warm and cuddly Valentine's Day.